Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Thanks for joining us for part two of my recent conversation over Twitter Spaces with Mike Mish Shedlock. If you haven't yet watched part one of this discussion with Mish, in which we dig deep into last week's bonanza of news and data releases regarding Fed policy and the housing and jobs markets, and what that likely means for asset prices next year, head over to our channel at youtube.com/Wealthion and watch it there first. Okay, let's get started watching part two of my recent discussion with Mike Mish Shedlock. Real quick, why don't we just wrap up the jobs part, because we didn't quite get to the part that I was hoping to get to, which is, I have been for a long time ringing the warning bell that I believe that a lot of layoffs are coming. That this this recession is going to be moderate to severe, and there's a whole bunch of reasons why I think that companies will be jettisoning employees as they just try to stay afloat, right? You have said, well, I don't want to put words in your mouth, and maybe after just hearing what you were talking about with the unemployment rate, maybe it's a semantic difference, but I think what you're saying is hey, the unemployment situation might not change as much as people are worried about, but overall, in terms of just people losing their jobs and having trouble finding work, what's your gut telling you it's going to be like?
That's going to be reasonably strong. We are going to see corporate buyouts. We are going to see, and I talked about this a little bit, there's 22 million people of retirement age, and 10 million of those people can retire, you know, with barely any impact on the unemployment rate. Yet there's 10 million people less working, right? So what Powell has said that he's gearing at, and what everyone else seems to be gearing at, is the unemployment rate. Well, it's what, 3.7%. We're going to have a new number on that tomorrow. So I don't think we're going to see a massive jump in the unemployment rate. And what's massive? I mean, on the small end of things would be, you know, a 1% rise in the unemployment rate. That's quite possible, but we can lose 10 million jobs and have a 1% rise in the unemployment rate. So, you know, Powell can use that as cover for as long as he wants. And I think he will use that as cover. And so, well, you know, employment is still strong. Openings are still strong. You asked me about openings, and I think, well, the number is inflated. But I think those openings are, for the most part, real. But what's going to happen first is the openings close. Then we have the buyouts,
right?
Like,
or
I
you
said,
have payroll freezes, you know, and that type of stuff.
Payroll freezes and. You know, but we also have a problem, you know, more so in the service sector. I think manufacturing, we're gonna start to see some things there, and that'll be an interesting thing to look at tomorrow as the manufacturing work week declining. It's been pretty strong, 40 hours or more. The service sector, the average number of hours, if I recall correctly, was what's the right word? 33 and a half hours of the basic economy, and some of that just stems from, and then we have weird reporting differences, like and the other reason why the unemployment rate can stay high is someone's working two jobs now, right? And they lose one of them. They're still employed, right? But a job got lost. So, you know, all of those things can keep the production and non-supervisory work week was like 33 and a half hours. The you know, so that's like the retail workers, whatever, and then they separate out manufacturing from that. So, you know, that's the kind of thing, you know, so we can lose a lot of jobs. And the other thing I noticed, and I'll go over it, every Friday, or excuse me, the first Friday of every month, I put together a pretty detailed job report, and something that I've been tracking for like 8 months now is the number of jobs reportedly keep going up. If you actually look at employment, it's down from 8 months ago, and full-time jobs are down like a million. But you know, everyone's out. Oh, look how strong the economy is. You know, because of jobs, they're looking at the wrong thing. They need to be looking at employment, and it's already weakening pretty severely. So when I say that I'm looking at numbers that in terms of the unemployment rate, I'm still sticking with that forecast, Adam. That doesn't mean we're not going to lose a lot of jobs.
Okay. And we're kind of trying to go with this is, you know, you and I, Mike, we can remember the dot-com recession, and we can certainly remember the 08 recession. And while the dot-com was more focused on the technology side of things, we remember the casualties of that. And I believe you might have even been one of them. And I was for a period of time, too. And so, you know, what I'm trying to kind of put a parameter around is sort of the human cost of the recession we're going to go through as measured by people losing their jobs and then having trouble finding one because companies are still shedding positions.
Mm-hmm.
When you think of it in those types of terms, you know, how concerned are you for what we're headed into?
We need to separate out a couple different things. There's manufacturing, there's the service industry, and then there's technology. A lot of these technology workers, a lot of these people, you know, got fired at Twitter, probably, you know, or Google or Amazon. No, not Amazon so much, but Google certainly. Meta, Facebook, you know, if they've been with those companies a long time, hopefully they've, you know, cashed out some of their stock options, and they're sitting in positions where everybody's going to say, you know, guess what? I don't need a job. And then guess what? That doesn't add to the unemployment rate, does it? So, you know, that's another reason here, you know, to think, you know, so we're going to have buyouts in manufacturing. The tech layoff workers, they're just going to say, I don't give a shit for a while, right? The service industry, restaurants, leisure and hospitality. Okay, you know, they had a big shortage, but now all of a sudden they don't. They're going to be firing anybody? When? So, you know, how bad does the service sector, the hotel industry, airlines, et cetera. How bad does that get? I'm just putting all these pieces together. And I'm just looking at the unemployment rate. I just don't think it's, and I'm alone here. I can't find anyone, you know, who agrees with me. I think, you know, you and Danielle and DeMartino Booth and even, you know, people like, Larry Summers and, you know, Paul Krugman are saying, you know, this is going to be really bad. Do we really want to go there? I'm got a quite contrarian picture here of what I think is going to happen with jobs.
Okay. All right. Well, look, I'm going to leave it there, and I'm going to let us open the Q&A here for the people who have very patiently been listening and for those who transferred over from part one after our technical break here to part two. So folks, if you are interested in asking a question, please raise your hand and I will pull you in here and let you be able to ask it live. And if you folks can stick around through the Q&A, I will have the last question be, what are Mike's go-to karaoke, you know, songs he's got in his pocket, because I learned talking to Mike the other day that he's actually a karaoke aficionado. I cannot believe that folks don't have any questions here. Nobody has raised a hand yet. Maybe I'll toss one out, Mike, just while we're waiting for a brave soul here.
We had a bunch of hands before. It's too bad, you know, we lost those people.
I know. But I got to imagine that somebody here has got to have a question that they're going to ask. Well, let's see. What are some of the big things that have come up here recently? Mike, what you mentioned that you're going to get a piece or two cooking for tomorrow. What what are you planning on writing about next?
Oh yeah, that's a good one. I'm going to dive into the latest GDP now, and you know, it's funny. I followed this for a long time, and GDP now seems to, you know, surge or plunge on ISM data, and you know, it's not really the ISM data, but you know, it just has to do with the leads lags of all the things that get bundled in, you know, to a GDP now update. I looked at the numbers today, and they were actually quite shocking. Let me see if I can pull them up here real quickly.
Right. And while Mike's pulling them up, just a reminder, folks, if you guys have a question, just use your little Twitter app there to raise your hand, and we'll pull you in.
See, where are they? I basically know the personal income and outlays report. I looked at this and I said, my God, what is the GDP now going to say? And it went the opposite data of what you might glean from just looking at personal income and outlays. And this is data that, you know, that comes out after the GDP report. Okay, personal income, the consensus was plus 0.4%. The actual is plus 0.7%. And then you look at personal consumption expenditures, shot up to 0.8%. And of course, if the price index is, which it was 0.3%, you got a 0.5% increase in real personal consumption expenditures. And at a time when you know the core is also, you know, down or only up 2.2%. So my gosh, what is this going to do to the GDP now estimate? And you go look, and it plunged. It plunged. It plunged, and their personal spending estimate plunged by, you know, more than a point. So what really happened here? And this wasn't the ISM report. It just seems associated with that. Rather, what happened was, and this is actually goes back to a surprise I had at the end of the last quarter, when, you know, all of a sudden, you know, all the data looks absolutely terrible to me, and the GDP now forecast surged. And by the way, a tip of the hat to Pat Higgins at the Atlanta Fed. He actually nailed the report. And I got into, you know, a discussion with him about that, and what it was import export data. The imports plunged, exports rose, it was that drove up their estimate of spending. Well, yesterday. And I hadn't even, you know, didn't even look too much at the report, but we had the reverse of that. If you look at the international trades and goods and services, guess what? Imports rose 0.9%. Exports shrunk 2.6%. Ding, 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 ding. That's what happened to the GDP Now report today. Consumer spending is taking a big hit, whereas before it wasn't really that we had strong consumer spending, but rather that exports were surging, mainly a couple of things, military equipment to Ukraine, government spending, and grains and U.S. energy exports. You know, we were exporting a lot of LNG, liquid natural gas, to Europe. So that explains the surge in GDP at the end of third quarter. And apparently that reversed yesterday. And I didn't look at this report yesterday. I looked at it today when I was trying to figure out what happened, you know, to the GDP Now forecast, and that's it.
Yeah, and so military arms and energy aside, not that those aren't a lot of money being spent right now, but the drop in exports is indicative of might what we might expect given these current macro condition where the rest of the world is not.
Yes, very slow, very slow weakening economy.
Exactly,
yeah.
where the ex-US economies are doing even worse than us, right? And so, yeah, mm-hmm. we're seeing that demand mm-hmm. fall off here. Okay, well, I can't wait to read that when it comes out. Folks, I'm going to give you guys one last chance here. actually, I see these little check marks, and maybe we do have two volunteers here. Hopefully that's the case. Hopefully these aren't just like Twitter verified people. Lance, I'm going to bring you in, and hopefully you are indeed volunteering to be a speaker here. If not, you can just beg off, but I'm going to make you a speaker here. And if you have a question, ask away. And while we're waiting for it, let's see, invite to speak. No, maybe these are just verified Twitter links because it doesn't seem to be letting me. Oh, there we go. There we go. All right. So Lance, if that indeed is you looking to raise your hand here, turn the mute off and ask away.
Yeah, I didn't know I was going to get pulled in, but if anybody has any housing questions, be happy to respond with what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing.
Well, what market are you in, Lance?
I'm in the Cincinnati market, but I cover most of the markets. I spent a couple years at Realtor.com before coming to Fortune. And, I talk to the different groups that are building different forecast models and have a good idea of some of the proprietary stuff that's out there. And then plus a lot of the public stuff too.
Okay. Well, real quick, tell us what you're seeing.
What's the proprietary stuff?
Well, a lot of the proprietary stuff would be like the stuff like you would see at maybe like John Burns Real Estate Consulting, Zillman and Associates, Zonda. And, you know, you kind of got to shake them a little bit to get them to say it publicly. Mm-hmm. But they've had a lot of interesting stuff. And they were the groups that actually went bearish earlier on. And I'm not talking like September. They were like April. And still kind of figuring it out in March. So it was kind of interesting to see their stuff. And then Moody's Analytics, Mark Zandi's a lot more willing to, you know, provide more of his data. So I'm able to share more of that publicly. But he's not even more on the bearish side. At this point, he's kind of more in the middle. And he's at like a 10% peak to trough drop nationally, with that just ranging so much across the nation from 3% decline in Chicago to like 18-20 in like Phoenix and Nashville.
Okay.
What do you have for Austin? Just out of curiosity.
Austin, usually depending on the group, there are a lot of times between like 15 to 30.
Wow.
Yeah. According to the Zillow Value Index, and this is something that's looking more at the middle of the market and it's less noisy. Zillow already has Austin down 10, which is the most in the country.
So Austin's down 10% from a year ago?
10% in like 4 months. Okay. Yeah. But keep in mind, that's a market that went up 70%.
Right.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That's interesting because I want to say the numbers that I was looking at only like a month ago were showing that the Bay Area was one of the very first markets, might even been the first market to go negative on a year-over-year basis. So it seems like Austin is catching up fast.
Yeah, catching up fast. And high-end real estate is always more rate sensitive. And, you know, San Francisco just has so much on the high-end side. And also, you know, San Francisco tech and tech's rate sensitive. And, you know, and then, you know, so many of the buyers there are dependent on their stocks. And that's all very rate sensitive. So the whole Bay Area is just a very rate sensitive market. And if you actually go back and look at 2018, when we had mortgage rates move up from like, you know, close to 5 for a little bit, San Jose actually went negative year over year, very, very briefly.
Okay. Well, where would you, given the data that you're looking at, because it seems like you pull in data from a lot of different sources, Lance, where would you put your outlook on the market versus, say, like a Mark Zandi, who you said is sort of trying to chart a middle course?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. I think a lot of it's let me say this. One thing that I think is interesting is looking at what are the different assumptions that get different groups to their forecast. And for Zandi, he's at 10% peak to trough national decline. And we're already at 2.2, according to the Case-Shiller that came out this week. But if we have a recession and unemployment gets up to 6, then he has it from 15 to 20% nationally. And if you look at the John Burns Real Estate Consulting, which they finally made public this week, they're 20 to 22%, but that's if recession and all of next year rates kind of hover a little bit above 6%. So I kind of like to know the assumptions, because as we kind of start to see how these assumptions play out, how inflation plays out, is it going to go away quicker and maybe the Fed pulls back sooner? Or is it going to be stickier and longer rates for longer? I really like to look at these assumptions to kind of help to, you know, get a little bit of a guide, you know, for how to read the data.
What do you have? Let's say the 30-year goes to 5%. Do you have an estimate for that?
That's tough. That's a tough number, because at 5% on these prices, it affordability is stretched, right? At 7%, mm-hmm. we're just like, that's so pressurized, it goes to a place that's even way past like 05-06. Where we've come to today at like 6.2, 6.3, that's very pressurized. But if you move down to 5, you know, a lot more people not only feel potentially more confident, but millions of people actually regain eligibility, because right now a lot of people have just locked out. You know, the quick move up on rates at these prices almost acts like a tightening of lending standards, because so many people actually lost their eligibility.
Right.
They don't even have a choice. They just can't get the mortgage at the price point they would be looking for. So if you move down to 5%, a lot of people regain eligibility. But then it goes to a question that Ali Wolf, chief economist at Zonda, just tweeted out. Are you more in the camp of, you think there's just a tremendous amount of pent-up demand, these people who are on the sidelines, whether by choice or because they lost their eligibility? Or do you think that during COVID, during this boom, there was this huge pull ahead of demand, right? Like pulling all of this demand forward. And that's an interesting question, and it's, you know, I don't have a great answer for it.
Well, go ahead, Dennis, finish.
You know, I talked to some of the economists recently at the San Francisco Fed who did that report that found that 60% of home price growth during the pandemic was because of the pandemic's increase or the increase in space that happened during the pandemic. And they're not just looking at the migration that happened around the country. They're also talking about increase in just overall space. And how they were able to do that analysis is they looked at cities with similar level amounts of in Denver, there is more workers can work from home, and in Utah too, versus Houston, right? And those types of markets, the Utahs and the Denvers, the places where you had even higher percentages of people who could work remote, you got even more appreciation. So it wasn't just people moving across markets. It was just the actual increase in total work from home and that increase in for space. And so where I'm going at with this is a lot of that demand wasn't necessarily fulfilled, right? For people to be able to buy during COVID, they had to pay a premium. They had to pay more. And that's what drove up the appreciation, more demand than there was actual supply. And so it's a question now of, does some of that demand just kind of disappear, right? It, you know, there was a boom and there was this FOMO and it kind of disappears. Was some of it just kind of pulled ahead? Or is there this lasting increase in demand for housing that was created by this move into a more remote world? And less of a, you know, we're going into the office all the time.
Yeah. How does one more question here, Lance. There's almost a near record number of units under construction. Are those units in places where the inventory is needed, where it's not needed, you know, do we have too much supply coming on here now or not enough still?
Yeah, so I'll defer to some comments made last week by Ivy Zelman in a podcast. She had said that there is a lot of this supply out here. And of course, it's more in the South and West and the markets where there's more building. It sounds like her view is most of the price pressures or the downward pressure on price that could come from that new supply is going to happen in the first half of 2013. It's already happened, right?
Like 2023, I hope.
Yes, it's already happened, and then into the first half of 2023. But according to her comments in the podcast, and I would need to track that down in terms of who she talked to, it would be less of an issue in the second half of next year. Like builders are kind of already making the moves now and then through then.
So that's when the supply comes on between the additional increase in supply. All the stuff that's under construction will be finished, mostly finished by the first half, or am I just hypothesizing?
I'm not quite sure how it all crumbles out, but in terms of it, when it's going to put more of the downward pressure and when builders are more worried about moving it, according to her comments, was we're already in that phase and then through the first half of next year.
Right. And we're already hearing all sorts of stories about, you know, builder incentives and stuff like that, that they're trying to out there.
And this week, John Burns Real Estate Consulting said that some of the builders are actually going back to people who are already on contract and giving them incentives because they don't want to lose them. Because so many people are canceling their the can rates moving.
But do we have the current cancellation rate? What is it?
John Burns Real Estate Consulting, their number they tracked, I think it might have been, it was really high for October because that's when we got the 7% mortgage rates. It might have been 20-25. I don't want to be quoted on that.
The number that I saw yesterday, but it was like really stale, was 26% in August. But you know, at least that's what I recall. What is it now? You know, so I don't know. And don't quote me on that. 26 for August. That's just what I remember seeing, which might be wrong.
All right, Lance. Well, look, first off, thanks for sharing so much of this with us. And other folks, if you have a question you would like to ask, please raise your hand. We'll pull you in here. Before we let you go, though, Lance, just a high-level question for you. I don't know if you were listening to the first part of this before we got kicked off by the technical issues we've been having here on this space. But Mike and I were talking about just the impact on housing prices alone from the increase in mortgage rates over the past, say, 15 months. You know, they've more or less more than doubled, right? And given the mathematical relationship between mortgage rates and home prices, you would expect that mathematically we would need to have a decline larger than what we've seen so far in the markets. And then, of course, you know, there's a whole bunch of other factors we've talked about here, recession risk, more inventory hitting the market, et cetera. But I'm curious, like just taking that first part about how much you think housing prices should come down just based upon the increase in rates alone that we've seen so far, how much further potentially do you think we may have left to go from that alone? Well, I don't know. Did we lose you, Lance? Mike, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Yep.
Okay. Well, I think we might have lost Lance there somehow. All right. Well, look, actually great that Lance was able to contribute when he could. He had some wonderful perspective and insider insight to offer there. Looks like nobody else has been a brave soul to raise their hands here yet. Maybe we start landing this plane, Mike. So in wrapping up, just because I promised folks I would ask, You apparently are a bit of a karaoke guy. I am a pub trivia guy. And actually, as soon as we finish up here, my daughter and I are going to go. It's Thursday nights. That's our night. We have a dad-daughter date. Go play trivia at a local pub downtown. You were just at one of your karaoke haunts. I'm curious, what were some of your go-to songs? And of course, Murphy's Law, now that I'm wrapping up on this last question, we have a couple of people raising their hands. So why don't you answer the question quickly, Mike, and then we'll maybe pull in one or two last questions here.
Okay. I do Johnny Be Good by Chuck Berry. I do You've Lost That Love and Feeling. I do both the high and the low parts for the right.
That is impressive. I got to say, Fred.
That's actually not as high as you think it is. I can't hit the highs of Roy Orbison and Only the Lonely, by the way. So, I can do Teenager in Love. That's actually a fairly high song by Dionne Belmont. I do Johnny Cash, Folsom Prison Blues, and Ring of Fire. And all of those that I mentioned so far are ones that I know cold, so I can take the mic, wander around the room, and put on a little bit of an entertainment act. You know, Brown Eyed Girl is another one. I do a couple of Beatles songs. I can do about 60 or 70 songs, actually. And there's maybe a dozen that I know stone cold, where I can, you know, wander around the room and entertain and sing to people and get down on my knees for you.
Well, folks, yes, this is a hidden talent. Mike's not only just a data hound by day, but he is a lounge spectacular show by night. Showing up in Vegas next week, right, Mike? And so maybe we can all buy tickets and see you at the Mirage.
I did and unfortunately it's removed, but I did Powell Be Good to the tune of Johnny Be Good. But the folks that own the copyright to that made me take it down. Unfortunately, it was a really funny presentation. I had this, it was called actually Bubbles Be Good. And I had this bubble blowing machine, and I had someone, you know, one of my friends who actually looks like Ben Bernanke there, and someone, you know, dressed up like Janet Yellen with a white wig, and it was really funny, you know. But unfortunately, I can't point people to it because they made me take it down for copyright.
That is hysterical. You really do put on a spectacular show, it sounds like. So, Mike, I love it if you put the lyrics to Bubbles Be Good up on your website at some point. I'd love to read it. All right.
I might be able to get you a private copy. I just can't post it.
All right. Well, do that. And yeah, next time we're on live, I'll give the firsthand reaction video to that. all right. Well, let's bring in Vic here. Vic Soyan. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that last name correctly. He's our first brave soul here to actually raise his hand. So Vic, I am granting you speaker access here. It'll connect to your mic and just turn your mic off or turn your mic on so that we can actually hear you ask your question live.
Hi, can anyone hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Vic.
Yes, we can. Yeah. Go ahead.
Hiya. Quick question. Yesterday I watched, actually day before yesterday, I watched Powell's conference. Personally, I felt he was very... He was very low energy. He didn't have the aggression. He was very passive, and I think he didn't want to fight the market. Now, looking at the 2 years, 10 years, which is about 72 basis points inverted, and 10 year, 3 months, which is around 80 points inverted. Do you think we could be looking at rate cuts in March, or the bond market is thinking maybe recession is much closer than maybe previously thought? Because obviously,
I think the go ahead.
Yeah, because obviously this is quite because I was looking at the history between 1980s and 1982, the 10-year, 2-year was inverted by around 200 to 250 basis point. And at that time, the 2 years, the 10 year 3 months was inverted around 100, 100 or 120 basis point. Obviously, this inversion is getting insane now. The 10 year 3 months, the 10 year 1 year, 10 year 1 month, even, even that is getting inverted like crazy, like 40 or 50 basis points it was today when I checked.
Right. The 3 month 30 year is like shocking. I think it's perhaps one of the most inverted in history. And the other thing to put how big this is in perspective is on a percentage basis. Okay. From where we were and where we are now, and just the spread in that basis, I don't think we've ever seen a percentage jump as big as we have. Back in 1982, you had the inversions, but the top end was at all the way up, close to 18%, or the inversion, one piece of the inversion was up, towards 18%. There's a difference between an inversion, 18 to 14. Now we're talking about, we're down here at four, and we're having, inversions almost as massive. That is a very, very strong recession signal. I don't, I don't think we've ever seen one stronger. But is the Fed going to cut next year early in March? I don't think unless, and this is what we discussed in the first half, unless there's some sort of a credit event, I don't think there's going to be an unemployment event for the reasons we just discussed. But is there going to be a credit event that would cause the Fed to cut? It'd have to be a pretty nasty one. More than likely, they would pause, cut a half or something. Powell is very, very fearful. You can see it. You can see all the Fed governors. They're very afraid of reigniting an inflation bubble. Now, that's just the way these guys think. I think their thinking is convoluted in many areas. But they're the ones making the calls, and I think they intend to see this thing through and hold rates higher longer. I don't think ultimately that they do that, but talking about a cut in the first half of the quarter, for the first or second quarter of next year, if they do what Adam said in the first session, the market's not really going to like it, because that's something really, really bad is happening if they're cutting.
Great.
Yeah, because the strange thing is, yesterday, means I have been watching Powell every month, with the FOMC. Before, he never said that we don't want to hike so much that we have to cut because we don't want to cut. This is never he said. What he said previously was, we if we over tighten, we can support the economy. That's his exact words. But yesterday, day before yesterday, he said, oh, we don't want to over tighten because we don't want to cut as quickly as we are hiking. That's I'm paraphrasing here. Obviously, I think the previous press conference, there was one of the Bloomberg guy. He asked him a question about the 18 years, 18 months, 3 months, something spread, which was like at that time when he asked the question was like 2 basis point or 3 basis points from inversion. And apparently yesterday, when the meeting was happening, that has already been inverted, like very little inversion. So the market narrative is, oh, that may have spooked Powell, and hence he's trying to risk manage this thing.
I think you're reading too much into it. His exact quote, and I've got it in front of me: "My colleagues and I do not want to over tighten because cutting rates is not something we want to do soon. That's why we're slowing down, and I'm going to try and find out what the right level is." You have to. There's a difference between the way he responds officially. If you look at his actual prepared speech, didn't sound anything like this. This is just
Yeah.
this was just an off the cuff, response that perhaps he regrets with the market reaction. And you saw all the other, you saw several Fed presidents come out after that, after the market reacted, and suggest that the tightening's not done. I think it was just an unfortunate choice of words on Powell's part. And he didn't mean to imply much into that. If you watch the full hour, which I did as well, I thought it was overall quite hawkish.
Yeah, it was. It was like I did not think when he was reading the stuff which he was doing the first like 10-20 minutes, whatever he was talking about. It is just like every time he says the same thing. We want to do this. We want to do that. And the job is not done. We'll keep at it. So obviously this was like, okay, you know, this is, I don't know why you have this conference if you're not going to say anything more hawkish than you said previously. But then when he started talking to that guy who was the disaster, even last year when he had this interview, this guy is so bad that I think very dovish, the interviewer, and he destroys everything. So I think he destroyed that interview. And he asked him about the QT as well, which he didn't want to respond. He just literally ignored and pivoted from that question as if he doesn't want the market to even think that the QT is happening in the background. I mean, that's what I felt. And I'm like nobody. But obviously, you know, just hearing that, I thought he did not want to talk about or even mention QT or what's happening with it, you know. So I think QT will be interesting because it's only 95 billion. But I think they're only doing about 60-65 because the MBS has nothing has happened to MBS. MBS balance is still the same. Probably they are doing about 60-65 billion.
You're probably pretty wrong on that. And the reason is, you're looking at what you observe, but there's almost a month delay in settlement on some of those mortgage-backed securities issues. That's why they always appear to be about a month behind where they said would be. You know, these things are actually happening, but you don't see it for a month after it happens. That's what's going on. I don't know why it takes a month to settle mortgages, but apparently it does. And it's happening, and people keep reporting to that. The interesting thing going forward is in relationship to housing, which is what Adam and I have been discussing here in this segment here, is are they going to go ahead, you know, with that? Now, is it possible that you're right, that he really doesn't want to discuss this? That's actually quite possible.
Hey, sorry, guys, I got to interject here. Thanks, Vic. We've got a couple other folks we're going to try to bring in as we wrap this up, so I'm going to have to cut you off here. But
thank
great
you.
Questions.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Mike.
Welcome. Yeah, make the questions, quick questions here.
We'll keep things on a tight leash here. Let's try to land the plane within the next 10 minutes. All right, we've got Monero Maximalist here. I am giving you speaker superpowers here. So don't forget to turn on your mic to be able to ask your question. There you go.
Oh, hi. Really appreciate you, Adam. I'm new to Wealthion, but definitely love the channel and new to Twitter. But hi, everyone. I just had a question. I haven't really been listening. I just jumped in recently, but I did hear you were taking questions. And my question is to the speaker that was just talking and to you, Adam, as well. What would you say to the, you know, everyday investor that, let's say, got lucky last year, sold the top of the market, saw the euphoria, sold the top, is heavy in cash right now? And what would you say to that investor? I understand you can't give financial advice, but there's just so much craziness going on. And, you know, you see on both sides, you can kind of, the bears and the bulls, you can kind of see the argument for both sides right now. What would you say to that person?
Adam asked me a similar question earlier, if I can, you know, chime in, you know, and my response was, I don't think we've seen the bottom of the stock market yet. I really don't. In fact, I think we're about halfway there. And I said, but my second alternative was, okay, let's assume I'm wrong and this is the bottom. Where's the market go from here? And then, you know, my answer to that question is, assuming I'm wrong, my second scenario is we just kind of meander around here for 5 years. I mean, this is how insanely overvalued that I see, you know, the market is. So, you know, then I think just based off of those answers, if you agree, you know, the thing to do is there's nothing wrong with being high in cash and being on the sidelines. I liked U.S. Treasuries, you know, about a month ago. They put on a really big rally. Gold's put on a pretty big rally. So, you know, there's some things that you can, you know, nibble at. Would I be touching this after this the rally yesterday? No. The other thing I would tell you to do is, you know, just pull up a chart of the S&P 500 and look at all the, you know, the gaps below. There's still a couple of pretty big gaps below. If you know how to read a chart and you know what I mean by a gap, I think those gaps are going to fill, and that's substantially below, you know, where we are here. So I guess what I'm really saying here is just be, you know, pretty cautious. I mean, if you timed the market and got out on time, you know, maybe you should be giving us advice rather than the other way around.
Hey, Monero, I'll just chime in on top of what Mike said. My shortcut answer is you should have that question with a good professional financial advisor. Feel free to, you know, talk to one of the ones that Wealthion endorses. But if you have a good one, have a conversation with them, because obviously the best answers for you are the ones that take your own personal situation into consideration. But I agree with Mike. I do not think the market has bottomed yet. I do not think the bear market that started this year is over yet. And Mike and I talked about this a fair amount in the part one earlier today. I think that patience will be rewarded. So I would not feel a lot of pressure to deploy the cash that you have. Although I will say, you now actually can get a safe return on that cash. And Mike just mentioned treasuries. You know, if you want to be super safe, but park in short-term treasuries, you know, you still can get paid an awful lot more than you could a year ago, and way more than your bank is still willing to pay you on that. So there are some.
Yeah, you really need to do treasuries themselves. I've looked at, in fact, I've been meaning to do a report on this, treasury ETFs, and I said, oh my gosh, How are these short-term treasury ETFs even down? As to go, what they're calling short-term, you know, is you know, 1 to 5 years or whatever, or 1 to 3 years. And guess where they were? Where they were all invested at 3 years, not 3 months. You know, so it's absurd that most of these funds are actually negative for the year, when if they would have just been in 3 months treasuries rolling the damn things over, you have a 3% positive return on these things at least. So it's kind of disgusting. So, you know, you just need to be careful. And, you know, if you can't buy treasuries directly and you're looking at a short-term treasury ETF, make sure you know what's in.
Right. And if you're a U.S. Citizen, you can easily buy treasuries directly. I did this myself through the treasurydirect.gov website. And like Mike said, if you wanted to stay in the short end of the curve, you can just set it up as a renewing function. So, you know, 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, whatever. If you want those just to roll over whenever they mature, you can set it up automatically. And it just sort of happens while you're living your life.
Set up a treasury ladder going out for a year or two or whatever, if you really want to be conservative.
Yeah. And the only other thing I'll mention too, and this is, again, is what you might want to speak with a financial advisor is, even though bond prices have rallied a bit in the past, you know, in the very recent past, with bond yields going up as high as they have, and at some point, likely the Fed is going to stop hiking and either, you know, have a pause or, as folks have been debating with us here, whether it's forced to pivot. Treasury bonds are more attractive than they've been in a long time. One, because they're offering a higher yield. And two, you know, eventually, if rates do start coming down, you get the option value of, you know, potentially pretty dramatic appreciation in these instruments. And the nice part is you get paid to sit in safety to find out the answer to that question. And so if it doesn't materialize the way that you think, no worries, you know, you're getting paid to wait. And if it actually does happen, then it's sort of gravy on top of what you're holding right now. So I know I've been talking with a lot of our, both the capital managers and our financial advisors that we have, and a lot of sort of conversations off the mic where they're saying, you know, this is a very attractive opportunity. It doesn't come along very often. So that's something to look at too, to, for folks like you that are playing it safe and waiting for better valuations to enter the market. Last thing I'd say is, it is definitely not a bad time to sort of start beginning to work on your shopping list. So let's say Mike's correct. We still have, you know, half more to go down. You can start identifying the asset classes that most interest you. And, you know, if prices do indeed start to go down, maybe even you kind of begin a dollar cost averaging program to be able to slowly build up a position in them and be positioned when the turn happens, you're already in it. So all right. If you don't mind, I'm going to go on to another question here, Mike, just so we can start wrapping things up. Let's go to Dean Canuck Monero. Thanks so much for your questions. Dean, I'm giving you speaker capabilities here. And just as a reminder, you want to turn on your microphone to be able to ask us a question. All right. Dean, I see you're still on mute there. So,
oh, there you go. I'm here. Hey, hello, everyone. I thought I'd just share a little tidbit, maybe boots on the ground. I'm a house flipper. We have about 48 homes in 6 different states. And,
oh, my God.
Well, yeah, not a good thing right now. Anyway, in about May, it was like somebody turned the light switch off. As soon as the Fed really started to get aggressive, It was not a cool down. It was literally turning off the lights. And what's been really interesting is, you know, I follow the 10-year because I really think that's kind of the tempo of the market. And last August, the only time we got activity is when the 10-year got back down to about 2.5%. Okay. Well, what's happened in the last 2 weeks, I'm in Southern California, just outside of San Diego. And what we're seeing is naturally demand, supply comes off big going into the holidays. So does demand naturally. What we're seeing right now, it's kind of a hockey stick move. As rates have come down the last couple of weeks, we actually put 4 properties probably in the last 5-6 days in escrow, which we haven't done in the last 3 months.
Interesting. And did you bring prices down at all, or is this
no? Well, yeah. I mean, we're gradually, but a couple of these are brand new properties that we just put out. 2 of them in Orange County, so they're $2 million properties. They're financed, but the thing is that they're so interest rate sensitive. As soon as we get these downticks, and my whole point being, housing is shelter. Right. So we haven't seen anybody buying anything. Everybody's sitting. Everybody, you know, loans are just working against us because you may not like your home, but you love your loan. So you're not going to move. Yeah. Well, all of a sudden, we're seeing all this activity. And like we had open houses last weekend where there was 15 groups coming through. Well, last summer, it was crickets. So it's just it's interesting what I'm seeing right now. And I'm not near as bearish as you guys. I think rates are coming down heavy and hard. I think the economy, you know, the Fed's hitting the brakes hard. The economy is going through the windshield. Rates are going to come plummeting down. And for me, it's going to give me a chance to get out of all this stuff before everything kind of implodes. But I just want to let everybody know kind of what I'm seeing with boots on the ground right now. We have had a major uptick. And just to give you an idea, in Orange County, just over the last week, we went from 89 days on market to 80, which is unheard of for this time of year. Normally, it's going into the holidays, everything shuts down. Inventory, yeah, demand, that's so interesting. All of it. Yeah.
So that's interesting. But, you know, I mean, obviously, you're doing this professionally, and Adam and I aren't. But, you know, my observation on that, there's a big difference between, you know, the high end, you know, tech heavy California, and, you know, what's happening in say, you know, other parts of the country. You know, one of the discussions we had, and I don't know if you heard it, with someone who had access to private data on Austin was, you know, how fast prices have actually, you know, collapsed there. And then, you know, there's, you know, what someone who's, you know, sort of sitting on the sidelines in California used to $2 million prices, and what someone in Dallas or Chicago or Austin or, you know, places like that, you know, there are Miami, just to throw out some possible names, is completely different.
No, I mean, no. Gets... And can I just rebut that for a second? So we're
go
also
ahead.
We're in Phoenix. We're in all the great spots. So Phoenix, Vegas, Salt Lake, Nashville, Boise. So Vegas is a complete train wreck, and Phoenix as well. And we just put a property in escrow today in Vegas. But here's the problem. There's no bid. So you're saying that these markets are falling, but they're really not falling because there hasn't been, like, we look at our properties.
There's no transactions, yeah.
There's no bids. There's no transactions to run comps. We have no idea how to price our properties because there is so much sticker shock because people that thought they were going to buy a home, they walk in and they're like, I thought I was going to afford this home, but no, you, guess what? You're across the tracks now, right? So they're not buying. So there is no bid in the market. Now, what we see is coastal properties, you know, obviously they're going to hold their value. They're going to move first. But what we're seeing in other parts of the market is kind of following that step. And all I wanted to let everybody know is there's a huge amount of pent-up demand, people that are just waiting. And you got three things working for you right now. You got rates going down. You got an improved stock market, which equates to the wealth effect, right? And then you got Jerome Powell coming out. I'm listening to this in my car yesterday, and he's giggling at the press conference where at Jackson Hole, he sounded like Volcker. So it's like all of a sudden, okay, maybe I'm not going to get fired next Monday. I can actually go out and buy my family a house. So those three factors, if we continue this trend, like I feel like all of a sudden the wind's at my back, you know, I'm not pedaling a bicycle uphill with a 100-pound backpack on. All of a sudden, I may be cresting the top, looking around, you know, that's kind of where I'm at.
I don't know, but neither Adam or I think the bottom in the stock market is in. We don't think the Fed is likely to pivot early. We think there are some marginal buyers, certainly, and you ran into them that are, you know, reacting now. Oh my God, you know, rates were 7.3 2 weeks ago, and now they're 6.3 now. I'd better jump. But, you know, whether or not that has legs, well, I don't know. Adam and I would disagree. That doesn't make us right, but I would just disagree. I'll let Adam chime in.
All right. Well, Dean, first off, I really appreciate you sharing this boots on the ground with us because it just is what it is, right? It's happening. I'm curious. So the rates have come off a bit, but you said things were a ghost town in the summer, right?
Yeah. Well, until when we got that downtick, do you guys remember we went from, I think it was about 3.5 to 275, maybe a little lower on the 10-year. And then we had some activity. We put a bunch of stuff in escrow, and then the rates just immediately U-turned, went straight back up, and then it was crickets again.
Okay, right. So my question is where rates are right now, where are they relative to when things were really, bad?
Hot? Really bad? Well, I mean, we're at 6 5/8 right now. We were at 7 3/8, you know, just, you know, a month and a half ago. So
right. But you said things were slower before then, right? So all I'm trying to say is, or all I'm asking is, while they've come off a bit, in my assessment, they're still pretty high.
Without a doubt.
And they may be higher now than they were, you know, 4 months ago when things were really slow for you. So I'm just wondering, you know, if that is indeed the case, then why are we seeing greater activity with a still elevated you know, still near.
Well, at the end of the day, it's shelter, right? Everybody needs a home and people have to move. Like, we're in the business. We buy houses because people die, people get divorced, people, you know, all kinds of, usually it's bad stuff. Unfortunately, that's life, right? And that's why we get houses that are messed up, you know, a lot of deferred maintenance and so forth. But, you know, the fact of the matter is people have to have shelter. So there's always going to be a certain amount of buyers. But what we've seen is just our activity, like in Southern California and the other states that we're in, the activity levels have never been this low. Never, going back to 2003, since we've been tracking it, they've never been this low. So, and
which I'm not, you know, surprised by at all, just given the rate of change of the mortgage rate this year.
Yeah. Right? But anyway, guys, I just wanted to tell you kind of what we see. And in my mind, you know, the Fed can't go much further because they'll bankrupt the country. You can't taper a Ponzi. It's an absolute Ponzi, and it's all posturing. And I think we're at the beginning stage. You saw it in the market. I think we're going to have a melt up, give a chance to get out. But I do believe next year for investors, you're going to have a really good opportunity when this thing really hits the skids.
I think Mike and I would agree with that. And first and foremost, again, I just want to thank you for, you know, reporting what you're seeing, because as Mike said, he and I, we're not professional real estate guys. We read a lot of articles and, you know, see charts. We're not there on the ground actually getting to witness what's going on. So this is really helpful intelligence. And I know that I'm going to be noodling on this for a while, trying to determine, you know, is this something that's going to be short-lived, or is this something that's part of a trend that I just haven't fully had in my picture yet.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you agree with us, at least that for the patient investor, going back to the question from the questioner before you, patience is probably going to be there's going to be a high return on investment on patience right now.
I agree. I think I totally agree with you. I think the only thing we differ on is I think we're going to have a little bit of a melt up. It'll give, you know, investors an opportunity to get out of their properties, sit on cash. And then I think we're going to have a huge deflationary event, which takes things down much, much, much further than people really, you know, worse than 2008. Just it'll be a credit collapse is kind of what I think.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. And just to be super clear, I definitely have, you know, my mind open to the fact that this rally could go further here into the end of the year than maybe I think it should. So, you know, as I've been talking about on my program a lot, at least the financial advisors on my program have been saying, probably a pretty good idea, if that indeed happens, to use this rally as a chance to unload at these higher prices and you know, get your dry capital built up so that if and when this correction we all think is going to happen later in 22, you've got the liquidity to take advantage of it.
Agreed.
All right. Mike, this has been great. Thank you, Dean.
Thank you.
We ask one last lucky questioner here to be able to ask their question. And then we let everybody get on with their Tuesday nights or Thursday nights. Sorry. Does that work for you?
Yep.
All righty. Okay. We've got two guys left, but I believe this fellow, Sad or Syed, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, has been waiting longer. So we're going to bring you in and make it a good question, because you're our last questioner. And don't forget to unmute your microphone so that we can actually ask you hear your question.
There we go. We can hear.
Is that me?
That's yep. You.
Oh, how you guys doing? I'm sorry to. Number one, I want to ask you your opinion, because yesterday I was hearing the CEO of BlackRock speaking about the, you know, the Ponzi scheme, the cryptocurrency world. He was saying that he has $24 million only invested in FTX. And he sounded very dismissive, like, oh, it's only $24 million. And when the CEO of a company dismisses $24 million, I know he's a trillion-dollar man, you know, $1 trillion company, but still, you know, that doesn't show that you really care about money. And what does that say about the overall culture, the corporate culture? Because there's so much, like, no due diligence, just speculation. The CEO of the biggest investment firms in the United States BlackRock dismissing $24 million investments in FTX. And the other thing I was going to also talk, I want to bring up, it's the inflation subject that is... think that a lot of people a lot, but from my, I purchase a lot of stuff every day, every week, and a lot of things have gone back down to normal. There are certain things that go up every year, annually, no matter what, we keep raising it up, like beer prices, cigarettes, and all that stuff. They're just annual percentages of growth, like or Coke or Pepsi or whatever. But there are certain items that are gone back to normal. So that's my two comments I want to just add and hear what you guys think of it.
Far away, Mike.
All right. In regards to the first one, I think it suggests that the bottom's not in. When just look at, you know, all the complacence and not panic, you know, over the stock market and, you know, people getting, you know, if I can say it in regards to the last questionnaire, I'll just speak my mind here, predicting a melt up because, you know, it, I don't know, and I don't want to be this direct or mean it this way, but, you know, people are, you know, believing what they want to hear and what they want to see. And we certainly see it, you know, in the crypto space. I get into it, you know, every day, you know, on Twitter, you know, with people still predicting $1 million price in Bitcoin. Why? Because they're holding Bitcoin. Or, you know, why are we going to have a melt up in housing? Because we're holding housing. You know, why is crypto going to come back? Because they have it. Why is gold going to come back? Because they have it. And I admit I'm a gold bug here. And it's very easy to get tied up into believing an outcome is going to come by that's going to be beneficial to you, just not everybody else. And that's, you know, kind of, you know, what I get a sense here, you know, from, you know, the people, you know, predicting melt ups. And here we have, you know, in this case, 24 million, you know, who cares? You know, it's a kind of a comeuppance. And you even saw it when, the, you know, FTX founder went on and did the interviews. It's like, you know, oh, well, I'm sorry. You know, it's when people throw in the towel, we're going to see, you know, some completely different attitudes, I think, across the board. Adam, care to comment?
I'm going to let you have that last word there, Mike. It's been awfully long here, and we're going to wrap things up. The one thing I'll say is I'm pretty amazed that we went through, gosh, close to 3 hours worth of discussion here, and this mm-hmm. is the first time we've talked about FTX. because it is such a meaningful development here and such a, I think, important milestone in terms of the devolution of the bullish, you know, order that is unraveling mm-hmm. right now. I also, while we've been on this Twitter space, Mike, I noticed that apparently SBF has been on a Twitter space as well at the same time, which I'm also going to think has contributed to some of the technical glitches that we've had here, which is...
With millions of people on listening to him, yes.
Exactly, yeah. So maybe we understand why this has been so buggy this time around. All right, well, look, with that, Mike, I want to thank you for being courageous enough to do this and spending so much time on this and hanging with me with all the tech snafus here. Everybody else, I want to thank you so much for listening, especially those of you that have been rolling with these technical issues with us as well today. Do me a favor if you can, if you enjoyed this conversation, first give us a little wave or whatever, or use whatever icon you can to let us know you had a good time here. And also, if you have not followed Mike yet on Twitter, go do that. And obviously, if you're new here and don't follow me, just follow me at Menlo Bear at Twitter. Mike, what's your Twitter handle? Is it Miss GEA?
That's it. MISHGEA. Someone stole the name Mish and was inactive on Twitter for like 4 years. I couldn't get the name I wanted. So GEA is Global Economic Analysis. That was the name of my original blog way back on Blogger and Blogspot, if anyone's familiar with that. So I picked Mish GEA. And about a month ago, Mish, actually, whoever had that handle, showed up. So that's not an imposter, it's just the name Mish itself, but a very infrequent poster that just, you know, turned up. So follow Mish GEA, not Mish.
Great. Well, I feel your pain. When I founded Wealthion, I went to go get the Wealthion handle, and it's been taken by another company. They've done 3 tweets in their entire lifetime, the last of which was in 2017. Yeah. But to date, Twitter hasn't freed those up. I did actually just read recently from Elon that he says they're going to start making a lot of those abandoned handles available. So who knows? Maybe you'll get Michigan. all right. Well, look, everybody else, thanks so much for hanging through this. If you have questions, remaining questions, especially if they regard what you personally should be doing with your finances, your financial wealth, based on all the things that Mike and I have talked about here, feel free to schedule a free consultation with the financial advisors that Wealthion endorses. It's totally free. There's no commitment to work with them. There are no strings attached. It's just a public service that they offer. If you're interested in doing that, just go fill out the short form at wealthion.com. That's wealthion.com. And they will be happy to answer any questions you have and give you their best direct advice. You can take that and hand it to your own existing financial advisor. You can follow it yourself. Or if you want some additional help from those guys, you can talk with them about what that might look like. Mike, thanks so much again. Have yourself a great evening. Everybody else, thanks so much for listening to us.
You too, Adam.